You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.
Congressman Jarrett. Look, George, listen to me. It's crunch time. It's personal. This is one of those moments. It's just you and the president. Now, what's it gonna be? Yeah, all right, George, can I tell you something? We're gonna win this thing. We're gonna get the votes we need, and we're gonna win this thing. And you know what I'm gonna do after that? I mean, that very night, I'm gonna go to Sam and Harry's. I'm gonna order a big steak, and I'm gonna make a list of everybody who tried to fuck us this week.
Lewis!
Yeah, well, just vote your conscience, you chicken shit lame ass! We lost Jared.
I hope so. Because, you know, if that was an undecided, then we need to work on our people skills.
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
Wolfman's got
nerve! Make love in the hammock!
What?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 117 for the 29th of January, 2011. I am Dave McVeigh, and I am still joined by Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
You've got that down to a T. It's like, it doesn't even hinder. You could do that on the spot without a moment's notice,
well,
I reckon.
After 2 years, you'd hope so.
I'm good, man. No, it's good to be here. I'm very much looking forward to talking this one out.
Yeah, me too. We've actually got some very interesting stuff to talk about today. In particular, we have our feature film review this week, which is True Grit, the new Coen Brothers film. But we've also had some very interesting things happen this week. What was going to be our major talking point, which has now become our minor talking point, of course, is that the Academy Award nominations came out this week, as well as the Golden Raspberry Award nominations came out this week, and we're going to talk a little bit about those. But we also have the Kevin Smith factor, and we're going to talk all about Kevin Smith today for those who haven't heard about what is going on, and for those who have, well, maybe we'll see if we can get engaged in some sort of conversation over this. We'll come back to that in just a few minutes, though. First of all, what is this show? This is Film Actually. This is the official movie podcast of the Geek Actually Network. We go out live every Saturday. Now, the starting time changes depending on when the Geek Actually show finishes. We start the broadcast at 12 p.m. Film Actually generally goes out anywhere between about 1:30 and 2 o'clock. Today, we're running a little bit late because Geek Actually started late, so that's just the way it is. But if you do want to join us in our chat room, you can go to geekactually.com/live, and we have a nice active chat room today, and we want to welcome everybody in here. So if you hear us talking to people that aren't in the studio, that means we are responding to our chat room. We'll always try and identify the people who say the good stuff as they come up. We like to start... Oh, we also have a brand new list of five. Now, this time it is actually a listener-requested list of five. We mentioned this last week. Rachel from the Funky Film Show at Radio Fremantle suggested to us in an email last week that we should do five great Westerns. And so we thought, well, with True Grit, well, five great Westerns makes sense. So thank you very much to Rachel for recommending this to us, and we will try and deliver our five great Westerns at the end of the show. But first, as we've started for the last 2 weeks, and we'll make this a third week in a row because it's so much fun to do, what have you been watching this week, Josh?
This week.
Or doing anything?
This week I have been trying to fill films as much as I possibly can. I'm sorry, the reason I look sidetracked is my phone just started vibrating. And
was it fun?
No, it's very disconcerting. I'm like, I can't concentrate right now. Let's just move
it's like,
that.
It's like my phone is ringing.
So yes, we Celine suggested doing the Evil Dead trilogy, which we did. We went back and watched all three pretty much back to back over the stage of 2 days. Really, really well worth it. Like, just to go back and watch that while I was doing work, which was very, very fun. Apart from that, was Burial Ground last week or this week? I can't even remember.
I think it was this week. I don't remember you talking about last week. So.
Yeah, no, Burial Ground, which is an Italian horror film.
Oh, no, you did mention it last week. Yes, you did.
Yeah, we watched that. We're lining up the other two very, very soon. No, it was, because it was when we were talking about Pet Sematary as well. Other than that, man, honestly, it's been game, because...
Delta says in our chat room, I have never seen Evil Dead 1 and 2. Are they any good?
You should definitely watch them. If you're not so much of a horror fan, watch 2 because it's a lot more funny than the first one, which is
I will actually say that part 2 is genius.
Yeah.
For those who haven't seen Evil Dead, Evil Dead 1 was made on a shoestring budget. It's got some cheesy effects. Very effective horror film. Was a massive success.
Yep.
In its day, it was one of the original video nasties in England, and it was just a shocker at the time.
Yeah.
When he got some money, Dino De Laurentiis, who passed recently, basically threw money at him to make Evil Dead 2, and what he effectively did was kind of remade Evil Dead. It's a sequel slash remake all kind of rolled into one, but Sam Raimi has a particular fondness for the Three Stooges, as we know, and he basically put a lot of humor into Evil Dead 2, and Evil Dead 2 stands as one of those absolute camp classics where you watch it and just you will fall off your seat laughing in certain places because it's intentional. It's not because it's so bad. It is intentionally funny. And Bruce Campbell came into his own at that point. The scene where he's smashing dishes over his head is quite frankly cinema gold. But if you haven't seen Evil Dead 1 and 2 and you're not a big horror fan, you might even skip Evil Dead 1 and go straight to Evil Dead 2. I would say for a matter of completionist, you watch Evil Dead 1 as well, but you could get away with just watching Evil Dead 2. And then Evil Dead 3 took a completely different direction. For the mass release, it was just called Army of Darkness. It is officially Evil Dead 3, which basically said, well, everything we did in the first two films, we'll throw that out and we'll make a fantasy film instead. Yeah. And it's hysterically funny in places, and it really is a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. It is still a horror film, though, so there are some quite...
Yeah, the scene in the pit's really good.
Yeah.
Near the beginning of the film, that whole pit sequence is fantastic. And there's also great homages to things like Day the Earth Stood Still, with his secret words are the words from the Day the Earth Stood Still. And there's all sorts of really wonderful homages in it. And it's a very fun film.
Mm.
Once again, produced by Dino De Laurentiis. So yeah, now if you haven't seen the Evil Dead films, they are worth watching. And I'll give you an idea. We actually played, we're not allowed to, but when I used to work in a video store many years ago, we actually put on Evil Dead 2 in the store. It was Halloween night. And we thought, well, you know, fuck the rating, who cares? It was rated R, but we put it on. And we were playing it, and literally within 5 minutes of playing that film, all our copies went out. Because people were just glued to the screen.
Yeah.
Because people had never seen it. They were sitting there watching it going, what is this? Yeah. And it's not what you expect.
No.
You know?
It's like, look, I mean, it is terrifying in parts for people that aren't fans of horror films, but if you can get past that, there's just so much to so much in it.
And Bruce Campbell is a legend. I mean, the man is, okay, he always plays Bruce Campbell, but he's so watchable playing that, you know?
He can play any type of acting. He'll always be Bruce Campbell.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't matter. He is an incredibly good actor.
Yeah, and the biggest stretch I think Bruce Campbell's ever made in his career was when he played Elvis in Bubba Hotep. But it's still Bruce Campbell's impersonation or interpretation of
Elvis.
And
you know what? That doesn't bother me.
Not at all.
I think the man's awesome at what he does.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was even good in Spider-Man. Yeah, he was actually really good in Spider-Man 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as the maitre d'. He was just fantastic.
Yeah.
Now he is really good. And somebody's pointed out he's Ricks in Burn Notice, and he's fantastic in Burn
Notice. Damn right.
Well, really good character in that as well. So yeah, Bruce Campbell is a personal favorite of the Geek Actually network. We will always stand by our Bruce. Very, very good. Even when he stumbles and does something like, you know, stars and They Call Me Bruce or something, I can even forgive him because
I still think it's funny though.
There's
there's
so much to like about him
and
about his personality. And if you haven't read his books, he's also written two books. One was a basically almost like a biography called If Chins Could Kill, which is a great book. And the second book he wrote is actually a novel. It's a work of fiction and is quite frankly one of the funniest things I've ever read, where he talks about this fictional movie that he's been cast in, directed by Mike Nichols and starring Gwyneth Paltrow, and it's all about him researching the role. And the film doesn't exist. It's a complete fabrication. It's playing himself in a work of fiction, and it is very funny. So he's a very good writer, and if you haven't seen or read those books, do get those. All right, but that's what you've been watching. What I've been watching, of course, is I'm continuing on the Mission. For those who don't know, I've got the Tumblr account where I'm watching one film a day at least, and continuing on, and we've got a few titles that we can throw out there for our listeners over this last week. What have I been watching over this last week? Over this last week, I watched. I went to see Tangled at the cinema. Nikki really wanted to see Tangled, so my lovely wife Katie and I went to see Tangled in 3D. Yeah. And I was so surprised. This is actually a really good film. I really enjoyed it.
I don't believe it.
I put up a first thoughts review on Geek, actually, you can have a look at. But it took all of the elements of what is normally a Disney film, and you're going to think, okay, it's going to be a schmaltzy Disney film. Throw into the mix the fact that John Lasseter produced it, who is the head of Pixar, and it actually ends up being this really funny, clever film. Not as good as some of the Pixar efforts, but a really good sense of humor, and quite frankly, the horse is the best character in it. The horse is just hysterical. They've given him such character. So I really enjoyed that, and the 3D is also really good. Once again, CG animated films, the 3D generally is. Yeah. Rewatched Toy Story 3 this week on Blu-ray. Holds up like a son of a bitch. That film is brilliant. I still stand by it. Rewatched Midnight Run this week.
Yeah.
The 1980s.
I saw your little review up there on the site.
God, I love that film, and I haven't seen it in quite some time. And rewatching it, I put it on, and my son goes, "Oh, do we have to watch?" And I said, "Just watch. You might like this." He was glued to it. He just thought it was great. I said, "Okay, the language is a bit salty, and by today's censorship standards, this film probably would not have been passed with an M rating."
Yeah.
The word fuck is thrown around quite liberally, but never offensively.
Yeah,
and that's the most amazing thing about it. And it's hard to believe that Martin Brest is the same director who went on to do Meet Joe Black and Geely, when you consider that his first couple of big hits were Beverly Hills Cop and this. And you go, wow, what happened to this man? And he hasn't directed since Geely, so he hasn't directed in almost 10 years now. So, but that was really good to go back and revisit. And we revisited The American President, because we got the Academy Award nominations this week, and Aaron Sorkin is nominated for Social Network. I thought, well, you know, I might as well go back and rewatch The American President, which is also written by Aaron Sorkin and is really the forerunner to the series The West Wing. And it was really good. I really enjoyed it a second time around. It was about a fifth time around, actually. But it was as good as I remember it. It's a really good romantic comedy done to a political background, so it doesn't quite have the schmaltz factor that you would think it does. And Annette Bening has also been nominated for an Oscar this year for her work in The Kids Are All Right, and she also co-stars in The American Red. And she is charming in that film. She really is charming in that film. So it's a really good film and well worth having a look at. Last night I rewatched Barton Fink. I haven't put the review up yet, but I rewatched Barton Fink last night. Boy, that film is a head fucker. It really is. You want to have your mind expanded and stretched. That's a film. But I got to tell you, John Goodman in that film, legend.
Yeah.
Great stuff. So yeah, we're continuing on. I've still managed to see at least one movie every single day since this month started. So we will continue on. James from Melbourne has said in our chat room, after I watched Social Network, it impacted my feelings for the character in Zombieland and not in a good way. For those who don't know, Jesse Eisenberg stars in both. I still stand by the fact that I think Social Network is one of the best films of the year. I got to say, though, I may have to go back and do some slight amendments to my top five films of the year, though, because we've had a couple of films come out since that we didn't have because they were released here a few days late. Or a few weeks late, I should say. But I think Black Swan may kick somebody off.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to... No, look, I based that list on what we had seen to that point.
Yeah, see, I'm going by the...
But, like, my problem is, Dave, you didn't see it last year. So no, I know. I think it's disqualified.
But it was the same problem I had with Harry Brown. I couldn't put Harry Brown on the list because it was technically 2009 film.
But that's why I won't let you change the list, because, I mean, the reality is, if you can't take the films from last year you saw this year, you can't take the films from next year.
It's a hard call. God, I wish we would get things on time over here. I really wish we would get things on time over here.
Yeah.
All right. So basically, if you want to follow the films that I've been watching this year, and Josh has also got one, but it hasn't been updated in a little while, DaveMcVeigh.tumblr.com for me, and yours is what, sorry?
This Year with Josh.
This Year with Josh.tumblr.com. You can find the links for both of those sites on geekactually.com. There's a follow us slider on the sidebar, and that will actually take you to our Twitter accounts, our Facebook fan page, and our Tumblr accounts. So you can find all that stuff there. Let's get into this feature review.
Yeah.
Because we have a lot to talk about today, A, with the film, and B, with other stuff in news.
Yeah.
So the film we saw this week is True Grit, which is written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, based on the novel by Charles Portis, stars Jeff Bridges, Hailee Steinfeld, Matt Damon, Josh Brolin, Barry Pepper. True Grit tells the story of Maddie Ross, a 14-year-old girl who's come to bring the man who killed her father to justice. She hires burnt-out Marshal Reuben Rooster Cogburn to help her track down the killer, Tom Chaney. They also end up in an uneasy alliance with Texas Ranger LaBeef, who is also after Chaney for other reasons. Although Maddie hires Rooster Cogburn because she believes he is a man of true grit, quote-unquote, it is in fact Maddie that the title refers to. She is a tough cookie and will stop at nothing to avenge her father. Mm. The film was previously made in 1969, starring John Wayne as Rooster Cogburn. It's a great film. There is no doubt about it. It was a classic. John Wayne won his Oscar for playing Rooster Cogburn. Mm. It is his signature role. And he also made a sequel to it called Rooster Cogburn and the Lady, which came out a little while later with Katharine Hepburn, which was also a lot of fun to watch. But it is fair to say that it took a lot of liberal changes from the Charles Portis book, because they took True Grit and turned it into a John Wayne film,
yeah,
which was what they had to do. And as I put up in my first thoughts on the site, I said Rooster Cogburn became John Wayne.
Yeah.
In this film, Jeff Bridges becomes Rooster Cogburn. And that's the thing. This film is a much more literal adaptation of the original book. Let's have a look at the trailer real quick, and we'll come back and talk about it. So here is the trailer for the Coen Brothers' True Grit.
Mr. Cogburn, in your 4 years as U.S. Marshal, how many men have you shot?
Shot or killed?
Let us restrict it to killed so that we may have a manageable figure.
Mr. Cogburn?
What do you want, girl?
I'm looking for the man who killed my father. The man's name is Tom Chaney, and I need somebody to go after him.
What's your name?
My name is Maddie Ross.
Are you some kind of law?
I'm a Texas Ranger. I know Chaney. It is at least a two-man job taking him alive.
Marshal Cogburn? Can we depart this afternoon?
We?
I'm going with you.
Congratulations. You've graduated from marauder to wet nurse.
We're being followed.
What do we do, Marshal?
You missed your shot, Cogburn.
Just let this go.
I thought you were going to say the sun was in your eyes. That is to say, your eye.
You got a lot of experience with bounty hunters, do you?
That is a silly question. I am 14.
You can run on for a long time.
Time for you to go home.
I don't like you. I will not go back, not without Chaney, dead or alive.
Sooner or later, we gotta cut you down.
Chaney's here! Help me, Marshal!
Now what, Cogburn?
Them boys don't think about the wrath that's about to set down on it. Chaney and his gang are a rough lot.
I do not regret shooting your father.
I will kill this girl!
Biggest mistake you ever made.
The God's gonna cut you down.
Help me!
I can do nothing for you, son.
All right, so that was from the trailer for True Grit, which is a great trailer. Somebody in our chat room actually pointed out while that was playing, they said, you actually forget it's Jeff Bridges, a sign of a real actor.
Yeah.
That's true. There is not a hint of the dude
in
this role.
Yeah, no, he is a foul, dirty human being for pretty much 90% of this
Absolutely.
Film.
He's a complete boozing burnout. And,
yeah.
You know, and he does it to perfection. He really does. My only regret for this year, and it's not really a regret because he also deserved it, my only real regret is the fact that Colin Firth did the King's Speech, because if he didn't do that role, Jeff Bridges would just walk away with the Oscar this year. This was probably my favorite performance from Jeff Bridges. It's just, he just embodied Rooster Cogburn perfectly.
Well, and it's just his entire image, like right down to the way that he wore himself, is just like he was walking around on set like a bum. Like there was no, there's no discernible Jeff Bridges-ness to any part of his face. And I love the way you said it with the craters in his face.
Yeah.
He just looks like a totally different human
being.
And the
fact that, as we were saying during the trailer, the fact that he's actually made that cigarette part of the character. Oh, it's a character to itself, almost. It's constant rolling of cigarettes.
Also the fact that he's so bad at it. And it's part of that kind of derelict look, though. He's just got these giant, badly made, like, cigarettes that kind of just are, you know, stuck together, and he's just twisting the ends to hold them all together and stuff like that. And it's just, yeah, like you say, it becomes part of his character.
There's this uncoordinatedness to him, and it's highlighted even more when he gets drunk. There's that sequence where he's drunk on the horse.
Yeah.
And he's kind of riding and is flailing in his
seat. It's funny, though, because at the same time, though, when he does the things that he just does, like, naturally, it doesn't matter what state he's in. It just happens. It's like the first time he shoots the bottle out of the air and actually gets it, and you're like, the man can hold. The reason that he can still drink is because he can still function when he's doing all of this sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It is part of his nature either way. Like, he's just that way whether you like him or not.
Absolutely.
And he has just some great speeches in the film, especially to Maddie, discussing things like how that bit that they're talking about in the trailer, where it's talking about how if you run down on four men, you know, like, the wrath that's, they just understand the wrath that's about to come upon them. And it's just, his delivery of these lines is done just without flinch. There's no acting to it. It's just part of the character. And it's just...
And it's interesting, because in the original, when John Wayne tells the story of actually going after four men with the reins in his mouth, because it's something that he's legendary for, and, you know, shooting twin shots out of his guns, Labeef and Maddie don't believe him. Yeah. And there's this whole thing where they're kind of laughing at him, like, oh, he's just an old man, and, you know, he's just full of stories. And so, of course, and kind of spoilers here, but when he actually does an action like this in the film, there's a look on their faces like, oh, my God, you know, look what he's actually doing. That reaction isn't in this film.
No.
Because you believe that he is capable of doing something like this.
Like,
you know?
I mean, it's really set up from the first time you really see him, not in the interesting little whimsical conversation that they have over the bathroom, but the later on stage where you actually see him in the courtroom when he's actually telling the stories. From that moment on, you just believe this guy is one hard son of a bitch.
He's made of granite. I mean, you know, that's the thing about the Rooster Cogburn character. We've had James from Melbourne has basically said, actually, the acting was all good, so I think the directors did a really good job. Absolutely. Look, the Coen brothers are... Their expertise lies in characters. Their expertise lies in getting the absolute best out of every actor that they've ever worked
with. And we talked about this, and one thing that I really wanted to make sure we brought up was the fact that it's not only for me the fact that they brought the... We know that they're famous for this. Mm. We knew we were going to get great performances no matter what. But what's really interesting is this is one of the first Coen brothers films that I've ever seen. I know you were agreeing with me when I said this yesterday, where you really felt like there wasn't the distance you have in a normal Coen brothers film.
Yeah, and I think
film.
The word I used last night when we were talking about it was I said the Coens specialize in disconnected people.
Yeah.
And there's always with a, and it's not a bad thing. It's just, it's the way that they direct. They're specializing in those people who are kind of slightly disconnected from
the ones that I think they would be drawing a lot on their own personal
things.
So, like they are the other kind of people.
The two prime examples of this would probably be Billy Bob Thornton in The Man Who Wasn't There and John Turturro and Barton Fink. These guys are disconnected from the world. They are emotionally
But even
dead
like Blood
inside,
Simple,
you know?
Like all the characters in that, like none of them have connection. You don't like these people
and
necessarily.
They're functioning, but they're not connected.
Exactly.
You know?
And in this, it's very different.
Yeah.
It's very different. And I was surprised that they really got it to work as well as they did. I didn't... Like, the Coens don't really feel like the kind of people that you would expect that from.
There was actually almost a father-daughter bond forming between Rooster Cogburn and Maddie Ross. You know? And which is really highlighted in this... that last finale piece of the film, which we won't go into, but you feel that connection between them. You feel that there is an affection that he feels for her.
Yeah.
You know? And it's obviously something that's taking him a little bit off guard because he obviously doesn't feel connection
for a
lot of people.
I think you really get the feeling between the two of them that from the moment he meets her, he's very surprised to meet someone like that, to meet someone that kind of really stands against what was... not more than a stereotype, but just an understanded way that you acted as a girl in the West.
Yeah.
You know, there was no true grit.
I love this
feeling.
The scene where I think that bond clicks is early in the film. It's actually because she wants to go on this mission, and basically he says no. Yeah. They leave without her,
yeah.
And there's that sequence at the ferry where she basically just takes her horse and just crosses the river on the horse and holds on and gets to the other side. And it's the look on Jeff Bridges' face when he's just looking at her and he just goes, "That's a good horse. I want $10 for it."
It wasn't only that. To me, that whole scene, like, that pans out, like, the fact that in a very standard staple of the time, LaBeouf just decides that, you know, this chick just needs to be taught a lesson and just pulls her aside. And there's that really, I think the establishing moment for me was the moment where he basically is saying, "Now stop it."
And, no, I love his line, too, though, if memory serves correctly. Something like, she actually says, "Are you going to let him do this?"
Yeah.
And he sits there for a second, and Jeff Bridges just goes, "No, I guess I'm not."
and he just says, like, "Get off her." And I can't remember what he says, but it's that line from the trailer where he's like, "It's the biggest mistake you'll ever make," and pulls the gun out. That's just so powerful in itself, because you're just looking at it going, "Oh, dude, I'd stop."
Yeah, I wouldn't fuck with this, you know.
That's the great thing about him, though. He has his screen presence, and like I was saying to you, I feel that Matty Ross really owns the first half of the film. From there, I really felt like Jeff Bridges becomes the controlling character. Mm. Like, she still does her role well, but as Celine pointed out, she has very few lines from then on.
Well, yeah, I think it becomes Rooster's film once they're on mission. She's documenting it. She's telling the story, but it's Rooster.
The whole time she's very disconnected from the story. Mm. Like, she always feels like she's kind of on a ride.
She's the Coen brother emotional disconnect.
Yeah.
She is the story.
But it's that fairy tale childlike thing where it's sort of like she's never actually involved until that last moment of the film. Until then, she's on a ride.
Mm.
She's just sitting there watching this pan out, and no matter how many dead bodies or whatever, she's still playing the 14-year-old. Mm. It's not until towards the end that she mans up and does what she has to do. And that was my favorite bit. Now for the gripe, I think the entire last bit of the film should have been shit-canned. It didn't need to be there. It was a waste of space. And it didn't finalize anything. It just made it even more disconnected.
And this is where we kind of disagree, because I didn't mind the finale of the film. Mm. I do agree with you that it seems to go at its own pace for three quarters of the film, and then decides to up the pace in that last quarter. And I do agree with that, where it's like, okay, we're just going to bring this to resolution now, and it's like run, and we run to the finish line.
Yeah.
So I do agree with that, but I actually don't mind the epilogue, and I don't mind that whole scene, because it is her telling the story. It's that Matty Ross moment where she's finished. My gripe is that the actress who plays Matty Ross as an adult is not as strong as Hailee Steinfeld.
Yeah.
And that kind of weakens it. I want to talk about Hailee Steinfeld for a second, because this girl's a find. And I think we're going to see big things out of this girl. She is the child actress who plays Matty Ross. Now, in the original 69 version, she was also supposed to be 15, 16 years old. But the girl who played her was 22 at the time.
Yeah.
In this particular case, the Coen brothers, because the book is much more about Maddie and not about Rooster, Rooster's a secondary character, they were determined to actually rework the film to be back about Maddie again. And so they were determined that they wanted a child to play the actress, because that's how it is in the book. And they did a huge talent search, and they finally found this Hailee Steinfeld girl. And she is awesome. She is so at home in a Coen Brothers movie, it is staggering. Those opening scenes where she's putting her father's affairs in order, and in particular the scenes where she's with the livery stable guy and talking about her lawyer. And did you notice the little cameo by J.K. Simmons as the voice of her lawyer? He's not actually in the film, but you hear the voice. And as soon as I heard it, I went, there he is. Yeah. But I thought those were just masterful. And you just go, I cannot believe. And at the time of filming, she was 13 years old.
Yeah.
You know? So I think she's a phenomenal find. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to see a lot more of her. And she holds her own against Jeff Bridges.
Oh, dude. And itself, like, just to have her on screen and just not have her sucked out of the picture by Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, James from Melbourne, when we're talking about the last few minutes, we're actually talking about the epilogue. It's not the Hailee Steinfeld, it's the stuff that happens
after the
wrap-up, the summary, which is what Josh wasn't a big fan of. And I think that the actress wasn't as strong as Hailee Steinfeld. Mm. They needed an actress who could play Hailee Steinfeld.
Yeah.
You know? And that was the problem, was that they didn't quite match that casting up. Overall, I love this film.
Yeah.
Overall, I had such a good time. I'm an unabashed Coen Brothers fan.
More than that, though, Westerns for me are made by singular lines or singular speeches. It's all about individual tiny performances cut out in like...
Or amazing characters. Because if you think Tombstone was made by Ringo. Ringo and Doc Holliday were the two...
I will quote the crap out of so many characters in that film because every one of them has... brilliant dialogue. Like, for me, half of a really good Western is just dialogue.
Yeah.
It's like, if you don't have that, these films are always bleak, and when you take away the gunplay, the screen has to be filled by really good character roles. And yeah, it may be a character, but it's all in the delivery. It's all in those things I can take away. And there is plenty of that in this. So many good lines, and so much comedy that is that
it's
really
like
Coen Brothers.
I don't know if you've ever seen the 1980... I want to say 84, 85 film Silverado, which was actually written and directed by Lawrence Kasdan, which I love Silverado. And once again, great characters. That film is made by Kevin Kline.
Oh, yeah.
And his character of the kind of the wisecracking,
gunfighter. I know.
And I love Silverado, and I love the feeling that Silverado gets across. It's got this good rollicking adventure kind of feel behind it. And once again, though, you're right. It's made by characters, by moments. And this is why it is always famous for a Western to have those amazing standoffs, because those are the moments where men are made, so to speak.
Well, and also it's the moment where a lot of the time in Westerns, you go for very strong characters. Like, you go for big budget actors to play these roles because you want really heavy hitting characters, and the important thing is that it has to be on both sides. So like in this film, to his credit, we were talking about this before, Billy Pepper is amazing. Is amazing. He's only in the film for like 10 minutes, but he establishes and soaks a character up in just that little time. And what I love is he's actually kind of a decent guy.
He's got honor amongst thieves.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I sat there the whole time, and it wasn't until about 5 minutes in that I was like, holy crap, it's you. And oh man, amazing makeup jobs as well.
And Josh Brolin as well. I mean, Josh Brolin, very small amount of screen time, but he did something with the character. He made you remember it. You know, the only actor, and although I think he did a good job, don't get me wrong, the only actor who was interchangeable, and you probably could have put anybody in there, is LaBeouf.
Yeah.
And his problem is that that's the character as it's written. It's a really interchangeable character.
But I kind of liked
it
because...
Matt Damon did an okay job, though.
I think Matt Damon was actually doing a really good job, but only due to the fact that it was really good casting. Because I think when you throw somebody who is the stand-up, pin-up guy of Hollywood, even when he's doing the Bourne films or whatever, look, he's still... most of the time kind of a pretty looking dude.
Yeah.
And to kind of throw him into that world and to give him a character that kind of gets beaten around a bit and slapped up and so on and so forth, it's almost like the acting was coming from a hurt part inside him as a person.
And it's funny you say it, because there is actually an anecdote we can throw in here, which was in the film at one point he bites his tongue. He gets dragged behind a horse and he bites his tongue so hard that he cuts through it. And so for the rest of the film, he actually has a speech impediment, which is quite funny in its own right, because he's got his accent on top of the speech impediment.
Yeah.
And I was reading an anecdote that actually said the way they got that speech impediment was they took hair scrunchies and they tied them around his tongue. And so basically he is having trouble talking.
And that's why he constantly looks mildly in pain.
In pain, that's right. And it works really well in the film. And I will say that he did a far better job at LaBeouf than Glenn Campbell did in the 1969.
Oh, dude.
Glenn Campbell was awful in 1969. You know?
And I also really love the dynamic between him and Rooster, because they are such different personalities of what is the, you know, sort of hardship kind of like...
And they have different ideas as to what's right.
But one of my favorite lines from Jeff Bridges is the bit where she's asking him when she's down the bottom of a hole, which we won't explain why or what's going on, but it's like, is LaBeouf okay? And he's like, yep, not even a rock to the back of the head can shut that guy up for longer than 2 to 3 minutes. Oh, man. So good. Like, and it comes straight from the book, this dialogue, apparently, but just...
And that's another thing to note with this. Jeff Bridges, when he was approached to do this film, actually said, why do you... And in fact, I'll bring this up because James from Melbourne has actually said, this should be the template on how to remake a movie.
Yeah.
I don't consider this film a remake. Mm-hmm. I want to make that very clear, because it's a readaptation of a book, or a readaptation of a book. Because in this situation, when Jeff Bridges was approached, he actually said, why do you want to remake that film?
Mm.
And they said, no, you don't understand, read the book. And they sent him a copy of the book. He read the book, and he then understood that the John Wayne film is very far away from the book. And a lot of that Coen-esque dialogue that is in True Grit is not their dialogue. Yeah. They've lifted whole passages straight from the book. Charles Porter's writes like a Coen Brothers movie, and this is why it fit them like a glove, you know? So I think, and I think that worked really well. I mean, that I remember, I haven't seen the 69 version in a while now, but I do remember the ending being very different. I mean, they do the standoff and everything like that. But that whole epilogue and everything, I don't remember that from the 69 version. I remember the 69 version just kind of ending at the point where they've finished doing their business. So it is. There are differences between these two films. I think overall, I'm going to go ahead and recommend this to anybody.
I didn't come out quite as buzzed as you did off the film, but I will say that it's brilliant, and it's Coen gold. I think I was hoping, due to the buzz, not from you guys, but from sort of the rest of the world, that I was just going to get something, I think, that hit me a little harder.
Do you know why I think there was so much buzz on this, though, before you go on? I think there was so much buzz on this because it is fair to say that this is the most accessible Coen Brothers film made to date.
But my problem with it is the Coen Brothers have a really strong ability to finish a film and leave you walking out thinking about it, like to really make you process what they've got on screen. There is no ending like that in this film.
No, because
you
they
walk
made,
out cold.
They
you
made
walk
a
out
very,
like meh.
A very commercial. It's the most commercial film they've ever made, in fact.
Yeah.
And I think that was on purpose in many ways. And you watch it, and this is why it's doing extraordinary business at the box office, more so than any of their previous films, because people who normally wouldn't watch a Coen Brothers film are going and going, oh, is this what the Coen Brothers are like? Actually, they're not. That's not what the Coen Brothers are like at all.
You're in for a rude shock
and watch Barton Fink, let me tell you. But it's a really accessible Coen Brothers. And what they did was they managed to craft an old-fashioned style Western. And it's remarkable. It feels like it's a Western that has walked straight out of the late 60s, early 70s, you know? I liked it a lot. And I understand, I think there's going to be some diehard Coen fans out there who are going to be disappointed, because I think they're a little bit like you, where you go, I was expecting a little bit more Coen-ness.
Expecting a bit more depth. That's my problem. It's like the Coens are known for depth and just using everything that they can, like making the screen presence in every way perfect. And I just felt like they were doing a by-the-numbers Western. And that's why I'm not going to give this like film of the year or put it even in my top five, because it's like, if I break this film down, it was a remake. It may have been of the book, but it was a remake of a concept that was already out there, and they wanted to do a Western by-the-numbers. Now, they did that, but you're not going to get my normal current.
I think the only thing that really puts this film through the roof is its performances.
Absolutely. And the new role, like the Maddie as a character, just having her, like showing her to the world, introducing her as used to put in the title credits, you know, introducing. And like, this is amazing to see this girl, and she is going right up on top of my list of people that I will watch.
James from Melbourne has said, and they also did this without one of those top drawer blonde bimbos in the lead role. Take note, Hollywood.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I will go one step further and say there isn't really, aside from LaBeouf at the beginning, before he starts getting beaten up, there isn't really an attractive person in this film.
It's a very
gritty, dirty looking West. People got bad teeth and bad hair, and you know, it's like,
you want to know what one of the reasons that I reckon this film is doing really well? One of the other things that I really think is benefiting it is, when was the last time you had a good Western come out? Like, when can you even name the last time we had a Western at the cinema?
The last really good Western I saw. Now, I didn't see 3:10 to Yuma, so I can't comment. The Proposition I liked, but it's so anti-establishment Western that I don't really even think about it as a Western. The last really good Western, and James from Melbourne just beat me in the chat room, was Unforgiven.
Exactly. It's like, people still like these films, and people know it as one of the classic styles of cinema. And it's just been that long since we've had one. Everybody's dying to go out.
Because Hollywood seems to have come up with this idea that Westerns are dead and don't want to make them. And yet every time a Western comes out, it's a hit. So I don't understand where Hollywood has got this idea that nobody wants to see Westerns. People still go see them, you know?
Exactly.
I think with it is important to note that Steven Spielberg was one of the exec producers behind this. I think with Spielberg's name behind this, with the amount of money it's made, and with the popularity of this, I think we're probably going to see a few more Westerns.
Great.
I think,
Let's just not have another Appaloosa.
Let's kind of stick with, you know, Unforgiven, True Grit. You know, I am actually going to watch 310 to Yuma. I've got it on my quick flicks queue, so hopefully that'll show up soon. Because Rachel from Funky Film Show said I should see that, so I will see that. But overall, look, highly recommended viewing. You don't have to be a Coen Brothers fan to see this. This is commercial cinema at its finest. This is what Hollywood should be focusing on. If they can make more commercial films of this quality, then we're in business, you know. And it is a great start to the year for us. It's the start. It's January. America was the end of the year, but it is a great start to the year for film for us. And we sit there and look at it and go, in January alone we've had Black Swan and True Grit, and I can think this year is looking up. It's looking better than 2010 at this point. Do recommend, if for no other reason, go see it to see Jeff Bridges really embody Rooster Cogburn, and go see it to see this newcomer, Hailee Steinfeld, who is terrific. All right, let's move on to our Entertainment Buzz section. And we were just going to dive in and talk about, like, Oscar noms and stuff like that. But I think the event that took place, I think it was Monday, if I'm not wrong, Monday our time, kind of gazumped all other news. And I think we really should talk about this. And before I get into that, though, I've got one quick little side note. This is just for the Australians. Doctor Who has always been really delayed here. And same in America. They always get it really delayed. They showed the Doctor Who Christmas special at Christmas time, and it rated its ass off. And so the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, has now decided that they're going to fast-track Doctor Who. So we're going to get it when the English get it. So
that's good.
So just for the Australian listeners, Doctor Who, if you are a Doctor Who fan, you're not going to have to wait anymore. ABC is going to bring it out as soon as, because I think they've realized that Doctor Who is heavily torrented, and if they bring it out bang on day and date, people will actually watch it.
I would watch it on TV. Absolutely. I'd have no problem with
it. Damn straight, I would too. And especially considering ABC has no ads.
Yep.
You know, come on, how good is this, you know? All right. That little public service announcement out of the way. Let's talk about Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
For a long time, we've been talking about Red State. We've been talking about this movie that Kevin Smith has made. Now, I actually have a trailer here, and we're going to play this trailer. For our audio listeners, I just want to stress that the trailer is very, very quiet. It's all images to this hymn. And I do suggest that you go to our site and have a look at the trailer. And the show notes also have a link to it as well. We're going to play it here just because it is kind of eerie, and it helps set the tone of what we're doing. So here is the trailer for Red State.
In the face of Jesus, on my way tonight, this first me old sinner, come on in. I see the face of Jesus in that great white light, and my Savior makes me whole again. In his shining eyes, in his shining eyes, I see the promise of all forgiveness to set you free. I see the face of Jesus on my way this night, and my Savior is there to comfort me. I fear God. You better believe I fear God.
Wow.
So good. It's just that one line just creeps the crap out of people.
That teaser actually gives me goosebumps at the end. It's when Michael Parks comes up at the end with that last line about fearing God. It just puts goosebumps down my arms. It is just, I can't wait to see this film. And I've said openly many times, this is my most anticipated film of the year. It went to Sundance for a screening. So he got a screening, and it basically says, and notice it says, you know, coming out March. So that was basically just Kevin Smith with a hopeful mind. He said that we're going to try and put it out there. And the promise was at Sundance that he was going to show the film. He didn't want to deal the normal distributor way. He was going to put it out at Sundance. And at the end of the show, he's going to do a public auction and basically auction it to a distributor right there in the theater.
Yeah.
Right? People turned up. It was a huge crowd. Everybody watched the film. They went to do the public auction. They said, who wants to buy it? Kevin Smith just immediately leaned to the mic and said, I'll buy it for $20. He said, sold.
Yeah.
And so Kevin Smith bought his film back for $20. The idea was that they weren't going to put this up for public auction.
Yeah.
He came. Kevin Smith then gave a 26-minute long speech at the end of the film, which you can actually find at geekactually.com. We have it embedded. I was going to grab some clips from it, but I thought, if you take any of this out of context, it doesn't work. You have to sit and watch the 26 minutes.
Yeah.
And basically, he just took Hollywood and threw it on its head.
Yeah.
And in one fell swoop, basically alienated everybody in Hollywood. It's really remarkable how much he was attacked over this move. Now, when you actually dig a little bit deeper and you find out how he was attacked, he's not being attacked by his fans. He's being attacked by the distributors and the critics.
Mm.
And when you actually start digging into this, which we will, you'll figure out why he's being attacked by them. But basically, in the short of it, what he said was, it's a $4 million film, and it's like having a baby and then having somebody else raise it.
Yeah.
He said, why would I make a $4 million film, then sell it to somebody like Lionsgate for, say, $4 to $6 million, and then have them throw another $20 million on it to advertise the film, which now means that after prints and publicity and interest and everything else, the film now has to make about $35 to $40 million before it actually makes any sort of profit whatsoever, and you're in the hands of Hollywood bookkeeping.
Yeah.
Right? He said, this is ridiculous. He says, and it's killing independent film.
Yeah.
They call it the Lionsgate 20, because every film they buy, they immediately just throw $20 million on top for prints and advertising.
Mm.
So he said, screw that, we're going to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
He's Smodcast Films and the Harvey Boys are his company, and basically says, we don't need all of that. He has an entire podcast network. He has an online presence. He has fans. And so what he's going to do is he is going to take it out on a roadshow, four-walling it's called, where basically you rent cinemas and invite people to the cinema. He's going to take it on, I think it's 12-city tour or something like that, and the tickets are quite expensive. They're like $50 or $60, but for that price, you get the movie and a Q&A with him and Michael Parks and other people after the film. You know, so it's an event. It's not just a movie. It's an event where, like going to like Popcorn Taxi or something like that, but with these filmmakers, and it's them doing it. You know? And I think that's a really interesting idea. And then on October 19th, he's going to release it at the cinemas through his own distribution company, and as he's put it, at much better rates than what most movies go out at. So hopefully theater chains will pick it up because they will make more money off of it, and he will release it in October on the 17th anniversary of the day he released Clerks.
Wow.
So that's the plan, right? Whether all this is going to work or not, who knows? Okay, but this is the plan. He is convinced you don't need the advertising dollars. He is convinced that through his network and his people and everything else, you have to be able to market a film yourself. He said the distributors have got a stranglehold on the industry, and he is convinced that you can actually make films much more successful, much more profitable by doing it yourself. And he referred to it as not the death of independent film. He referred to it as independent film 2.0.
You know?
It's the next generation. I think his one quote that I loved where he said, I used to be an independent filmmaker 17 years ago, and then I sold a movie. And really, he hasn't been an independent filmmaker since.
Yeah.
And that's the point that he was trying to raise. And he picks an anniversary date for his personal reasons instead of viewer demand. And this is another thing. This whole concept of peak seasons and this and that and next thing. You can release a movie any time of year and make money. Why would you want to release it in the summer season when it has to compete with everything else around it?
Mm.
You know? Find a date that works. You want as little competition around you as possible. You know, I mean, that would be really the way to do it. You know, people say traditionally March is a dead season, and yet we've seen, and they're not great films, but yet in March we saw Ghost Rider and Daredevil both make huge amounts of money in March because there was nothing else around them. You know, people are starved for content. I think he's on the right track. You had some serious thoughts about this.
Well, look, we have an article that will probably pop up today from me where I was writing down my first thoughts about the whole situation. I'm just so mind-boggled that people are so angry about this.
Me too.
It does my head in because when I actually look at what's going on, this isn't the first time this sort of concept's happened. The music industry had this, for anyone that is a fan, will remember Trent Reznor and Radiohead and so on, went out and did this in the music industry and basically went, we're going to release an album and we're not having anything to do with publications. We're just going to put it out ourselves and we're going to see what happens. Trent Reznor did it for free, by memory. Radiohead had a donation thing. Hmm. So just put whatever you think is worth it. no one will talk about it, but apparently they made lots of money off this. Yes. Because the average donation was about $6 to $7, apparently, because people were just going, yeah, I like Radiohead, and I don't have $40 or $35, but I'll give you $7 because I've got that in my account. And they made a lot of money off this, and of course there was no overheads or anything, so the album was then released later on down the track. And this is what I don't think people realize. This doesn't mean the world is about to change and the whole thing's going to pull apart. As I say in the article, reality is 90% of directors and filmmakers do not have the time to do what he is about to do.
Or the fan base, or all, I mean, there's so many factors. Now, somebody's actually said that in our chat room. James has said, I think, Callison says... where is it? Sorry, I've moved up now. Where is it? Hold on. Somebody, you'll jump in and tell me, I'm sure, but basically said here it is. Carlson says he doesn't need it, but I think not every independent filmmaker can do what he wants to do.
Well,
absolutely granted.
This is my biggest argument, is the fact that people have to realize that this man is a god of the internet. Like, this man is one of our Leo Laportes or whatever. This man brushes a comment or throws it out on Twitter or just says it once and the world is affected. Like, ripples are felt by his very steps. And I mean, I don't want to make the guy, like, I'm not saying
he doesn't walk on water or anything.
I'm not saying he can't do wrong, but he can't be ignored.
He's a gig god. I mean, let's
exactly
face it.
And this is the reality. The man has such a powerful force. By commenting one Twitter and going, I'm going to make a movie, the world knows about it. Because every one of those people will tell their friends that are into his movies, and the world gets told. So
this is the irony as well. There was actually, I can't even remember what website I was reading now, but somebody actually said, to try and release a film with no advertising, good luck with that. Because he said point blank, I am spending not a dollar on advertising, right?
And doesn't have a dollar he needs to spend.
And he basically said the only money they're going to spend is on prints to get it into the cinemas. He's not paying for advertising. And everybody immediately jumped on that saying, you can't release a film without advertising. He didn't say he wasn't going to advertise the film.
He said
I wasn't going to pay for advertising. Let's face it, when this film has sparked so much comment, it is swept across all the various blog sites and major newspaper publications are talking about all the stuff he's done. It's already advertised. And every step he takes on this tour is going to be promoted and advertised by blogs and everybody else like us and Slash Film and all these other places. This is what he's relying on. He's relying on word of mouth to go out there and just spread like wildfire. You know?
The great thing about it is...
And I don't think he could have done this with a Jay and Silent Bob film. He's done something unique and new and different.
Yeah.
You know?
But he's thought about this. Like, I mean, the man spends a lot of time thinking and masturbating, if you believe him. But the reality is that the guy sat back and gone, I have a chance to try something here. I have a power that not many people on Earth wield. And I can probably make this work. Now, it doesn't matter if it doesn't do $150 million on its first weekend. It doesn't matter because he's not paying the same overheads.
And in fact, he actually said that in his... He's actually got a... Now, we've got links in our show notes to all these various articles. And the last link in our show notes is actually called theredstatements.com. And it's basically kind of like his manifesto. He's been asked this question so often that he finally wrote it in like an essay form.
Yeah.
And one of the things he actually does say about all this is that... You know, his hope here is that once this film comes out, shows that this kind of model will work, he then wants to help other independent filmmakers get their product out.
Yeah.
He will use his network, he will use his resources to then help the next generation of independent. So it's not like this completely selfish thing that he's doing. He's trying to promote independent film. And he actually said, Hollywood has become completely dependent on that opening weekend gross. He said this is some magical number that doesn't actually mean anything.
Yeah.
And a film like Batman Begins, if you remember, actually had a shocking opening weekend, and word of mouth built it to be a huge hit over the course of many weeks until it topped over the $200 million mark. And that's what he's basically saying. He's saying you can't judge a film on its opening weekend. They release a film, it dies in its first day, and they go, oh, pull it from release.
Yeah.
It's like, stop, give it a chance, you know?
And more than that, like, who are you to say that you could just pull a film? This is someone's lifeblood. These are actors and stuff like this. It's like the whole concept of Hollywood controlling so heavily what they do. I want this to shake. I want you to grab the roots of this tree and freaking rip it out and just see what happens.
Yeah.
Like, change is not necessarily a bad thing. And more to the point, I don't really see this being something that's going to change the entire world of cinema. You're still going to get your summer blockbusters.
Studios are still going to do their thing.
And, you know, the only thing that might happen here is people might start to realize this. I mean, we've seen people so scared to make these jumps. Joss Whedon releases Dr. Horrible's sing-song blog, becomes an incredible hit, gets released, goes on iTunes, eventually made it to DVD, didn't it?
Yeah, it's on DVD.
So this film hits all these things, but no one really realized...
And initially released for free.
And there's the thing. We have to start overcoming the realities that the whole world of cinema and film and everything is changing. And the whole power is shifting everywhere in the film industry. And it's just like... The only people that haven't realized it are the people that still hold all the cards, the ones up the top pulling the strings. And realistically, the more the people down the bottom start to realize they don't have to play this game, the more the whole world changes, and we might start seeing some cinema that just breaks the lines.
This is also not Kevin Smith as well. I mean, somebody was saying, but he's got all these resources. Let's take the Wayback Machine back to 1998, 99, when Blair Witch Project was coming out. All right. Now, the Blair Witch Project was made on $10,000 or whatever it was.
Or even more recently, Paranormal Activity.
And Paranormal Activity. But the case of Blair Witch was a fascinating one because Blair Witch, they made the film, they put the website up, they got the buzz moving, they got all this incredible buzz out of it until finally a distributing company picked it up, put it into the cinemas. By the time they put it in the cinemas, the film turned over $250 million or something because the hype on this film was so big before it ever got there. You know? And they did that. That wasn't studio built.
Exactly.
You know? And that's the thing. It takes being clever. Is what it takes. And that's what Kevin Smith is talking about. He's saying, let's do something. Let's think differently. Let's try something new. Because the current system, unless you are a blockbuster film, unless you are a studio-backed film, is broken.
Yeah. You know? Well, as an example, though, The Blair Witch is an amazing thing. Because just imagine if they built up all that thing and then they dropped it on the website and put a PayPal/credit card system and went, watch the movie here. Like, this is now. Like, today. Mm-hmm. Watch the movie here for $5. My God. Even if you got a whole group of friends round to the house and watched it, that buzz is still going to go to your friends and so on and so forth. And it's like you can make your money with no overheads.
Now, James, I actually disagree with you. James says changes to Hollywood happen from the inside, not people who burn all their bridges and are now on the outer. I actually disagree with that because let's talk about... The problem is changes from the inside are very rare to happen because it's an established system.
Mm.
United Artists, which now, okay, is struggling and so forth, but was a major force many years ago. United Artists was a bunch of actors who basically didn't like the studio system, led by Charlie Chaplin, who basically said, fuck this, and went out and formed their own production company.
Yeah.
You know, because they didn't like the way it was being done, and so they did it themselves. Sometimes you've got to be rogue. Sometimes you've got to say, I'll tell you what, I'll try it my way. You may fall flat on your face, but why? To quote Batman, why do you fall down? So you can stand back up and try again, you know?
And it's like... And also, like, I don't like the fact that... I don't like the concept of burning bridges. In the speech, I don't really feel like he does that. He says he doesn't like the way things run. He says he doesn't want to give it to the thing. He doesn't turn around and go, fuck you, and fuck you. He doesn't turn around and alienate these people. If he turns around later on in his career, makes a movie, and brings a publishing company, it'll be because he can't fund it himself. Mm. This isn't a case where he sat down and gone, I can do this. I can make profit off this. I can turn this around myself. I'm going to try something new. That doesn't mean that he turned around and went, all of you guys are screwed, and if this doesn't work, well, forget you. I'm just going to keep trying to make films this way. He's gone, I have an idea, and I'm going to not run with one of you.
And the bottom line is he has nothing to lose at this point. And this is a fair point to make. Kevin Smith has actually openly said he only has one more film in him, right?
Yeah.
He basically said that he's reached a point in his life where he's actually not as much of a filmmaker anymore as he is a web person and a podcaster and a Q&A person. And he likes doing what he's doing. He says he's got one more film in him, which is a film called Hit Somebody about hockey.
Yeah.
Which has already been financed the same way he financed Red State.
Yeah.
It's already been cast by most of the cast of Red State. He's starting to film that at the end of the year. And he said after that is done, he's done. This is his Red State's his penultimate film. He's basically done as a filmmaker. He wants to try a distribution model. So he basically, after Hit Somebody is done, he wants to try and get other independent filmmakers stuff to happen. Now, if this whole experiment falls flat on its face, it's not like he's going to be scrambling to try and find distributors for films that he's not going to make.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's kind of, he's picked the right time in his life to basically say, well, let's try this.
Yeah.
And yes, he is, in some ways, he has burnt bridges. He hasn't told people to fuck off, but he basically has rocked the establishment and people are pissed.
Yeah.
Right? Now, distributors are pissed because, let's face it, a lot of people don't know this, and I think we should say this. Cinemas make jack shit from ticket prices.
Yeah.
You go to the cinemas and they're charging you $18 a ticket. It's not the cinema that is gouging you.
Yeah.
It is the distributors who are gouging you. The cinemas make about $1 off of a cinema ticket. Where they make their money is off popcorn and Coke and all the other bits and pieces that they sell.
That's why they're like $1 million
a drink. That's why they're like $1 million. I have many friends who have worked in cinemas before, and they basically say ticket prices, the movies are rented from the distributors, and you have to pay them back. And when you pay them back, you're paying them huge amounts of money. So what Kevin Smith has said is when he approaches the cinema chain and says, here's my film, he's talking about doing really good exchanges of deals with these cinema dollars. So let's face it, he goes to a cinema and says, I tell you what, you put my film in your cinema and you get 50% and I get 50% or whatever the case might be, right? Yeah. A cinema chain's going to go, okay, you know, that sounds like a good plan. But the problem is the distributors are freaking the fuck out about this because this goes against everything that they are about because this is how they make their money, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's basically rocking their world. The next question I had about all this is why are the critics so pissed off? The critics have gone nuts. He's had so much bad press.
Well, because to me, I think the big reason is that, look, and I can understand as someone that is trying to get into the world of journalism, I understand the fear, but I do this, what I do at the moment, for a love of what I do. And we both do. We do it because we love cinema, we love tech, we love games, and we show up here every week to put out a show because we want to talk about film, right? Mm-hmm. But there are people out there that are being paid for this. When you start pulling out all of the production companies and the distribution chains and stuff like this, you lose screenings. And like you were saying, you lose exclusives and stuff like this. Look, more than magazines, this goes right through the entire world. And I can understand why people are pissed off at this. It makes sense to me. We lose a job.
Well, let's face it. The critics look at it and go, if you're going to do this with no advertising, that means there's no press junket. That means there's no exclusives.
Yeah.
That means there's no purchases. You know what I mean? People aren't going to come because there's nothing for them to read.
But I think a friend of mine put it best, and I mean, he's a lot harsher than I am, believe it or not. I don't believe people think that that's possible. But he basically turned around when I was talking to him and explained that to him, and he said, tough shit. If you can't write a decent opinion, get out of the game. And I thought that was one of the, I thought that was one of the best things I've ever heard. He's realistically saying, exclusives are fine, and exclusives are cool. And if you can get close enough to these people to get that, great. But it doesn't make you a good writer. Your writing should come from that. I'm not standing on a pedestal and saying I can do better. What I'm saying is the reality is people will come to you if your opinion or the way the slant you're talking about on the film or what you want to discuss about it makes sense. The best pieces that you will get on a site, we can both agree on this as people that run sites, the best pieces you will get are really good opinion pieces.
Yes.
They are what will drive your market. All the news and information, everywhere
now. The biggest hits on Geek actually are the ones where we go off on rants.
Exactly.
Where we talk about stuff, you know? So
all of the rest is filler. All of the rest is between those moments. All of the rest is sharing with the world stuff you found out. And realistically, magazines just get that quicker than we do.
Yeah.
That's the reality. The internet is starting to take over that world. And I can understand. That scares people.
Do you know who we should get on the show?
Who?
I'd like to try and get Holly on the show.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear what Fox has got to say about it. I'd like to hear what Fox has to say about it. We'll see if we can get Holly McKay on the show at some point and actually get some opinions of what the what corporate is thinking about all of this, because I think it's really interesting. There's been a lot of stuff going in the chat room here.
Interesting question up. What is he saying? But can you keep your integrity and become an honest journalist? Or do you have to sell out to make it to the big time? You do, in my opinion. Straight up. I think people can put out what they want, but as an example, and I'm not going to give names at all, but what I'm going to say is at DLC, we have people coming that are way above our pay grade and writing for us under pseudonyms because they can't write what they want to say.
Mm.
Because they're not allowed. Well, because they are under strict requirements.
There was actually we actually had a situation, and we can talk about this because it was talked about on the show. But remember when Dave on Platforms was talking about the fact he gave a bad review to a game and was ostracized for it, you know?
Rockstar, a perfect example. Rockstar have fired people, had people fired. Kanan Lynch from GameSpot, another perfect example. You give a bad review to the wrong game at the wrong time, if they've dropped enough money in the advertising, and stuff will go sour.
And this is why you've got to admire, as much as I hate him, you have to admire somebody like Armand White, who basically writes exactly what he wants to write. And he pisses everybody off, but he manages to hold a job.
Yeah, good on him, man.
It's like you sit there and look at him and go, I hate him and I hate everything he has to say.
Yeah.
But you got to admire the gusto in the man, you know?
Yeah. He will stand there and write the opposite of what everyone else thinks. And you know what? People will read it just to rage at him.
Absolutely. So there is something to be said for that. Look, the chat room has gone berserk, and I can't keep up with it, quite frankly. Yeah. There's so much going on in there. Look, even the chat room, we're getting conflicting opinions on the whole Kevin Smith thing. It's really interesting. It has actually brought up bile in a lot of people, this entire thing. It's almost like, don't rock the boat. Now, there's a saying where they say that new ideas, new concepts are always approached in three stages.
Yeah.
At first, people get angry at change. Then it's followed by ridicule, where people make fun of it.
Yeah.
And then it's followed by acceptance.
Yeah.
And this is what's going to happen. Everybody's angry at the moment.
Yeah.
Give it another year, people will start making fun of him. Oh, that Kevin Smith, look at him. He's doing that funny little thing that he's doing. And then eventually, when he makes a couple $100 million of this, people go, that's a model we should have a look at, you know? And so, as I say, it's following the three stages. You know, these three stages are always followed in this way. At the moment, we're in that anger stage.
Yeah.
People are angry at this, and it's really, really interesting to watch. I personally, on the record, I support him 100%. I think, I look at him and I go, if you watch his speech and the way he delivers his speech, if you read his manifesto and you look at the words coming out of his mouth, he is not being harsh. He is just basically saying, that system doesn't work for me, and I want to try something new.
Yeah.
And I say, good on you for trying something
new. I say the word, like, I mean, I'm giving away so much of my article already. It's just, it's
pointless. Well, people will still read it anyway.
Yeah, but the whole thing is, my last thing about the whole thing is, if it wins, I end up with a new type of distribution which allows for, you know, sort of removing the style and, you know, sort of the unnecessary sort of things that you have to put inside a film to make it make money. It removes great things like, you know, animated animals and so on and so forth that we don't really want in the film. If it fails, we might end up with a whole another batch of the cinema nasties. And I win either way because I love film. And even if it's crappy film, I can see elements in it that are awesome. And look, either way, if it goes cheap budget films that, you know, may or may not be good, it's still someone that I will watch now because it's a type of film that will be different from everything else I see.
Now, I've actually tweeted Kevin Smith twice over the last week.
Yeah.
First one was I'm asking whether or not there's any news about an Australian release date or what's going to happen with an Australian release. And the second one, of course, is I've actually asked him whether or not he would like to Skype in and talk to us. I haven't received an answer yet, but I will keep on this because I would like to talk to him.
I have some interesting ideas for things I would like to try and put into place to see whether or not I could get him to this country, which if anything manages to manifest, I will let everyone on the show know. But I am personally going to be driving to get him here. So we'll see if I can get
And look, quite frankly, if you are listening to this and you are at all involved in places like the Ritz Cinema or the Valhalla or the Astor in Melbourne or any of these little independent houses, you should be on the phone right now to Kevin Smith trying to secure a distribution for this film. He'll do you good terms and you'll get exclusivity to it. You know, this is not a film that he's going to want to release to Hoyts or the Dendy or any of these other major chains. He's going to want to release this to the little independent houses. And that being the case, I would be on the, if I owned a cinema right now, I would be on the phone right now saying, I will take this whenever you give it to me. You know, in fact, I would even be going so far as to say, can I fly you out here for a Q&A? I don't own a cinema, although I would love to.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Now that would be awesome.
Wouldn't it just be awesome? I was fantasizing about this the other night with my lovely wife, Katie, saying, boy, wouldn't it be great to own a cinema? Not a chain cinema, but a little independent house where you could literally just play anything you want to play. I think that would be awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so look, that will leave Kevin Smith there. There's a lot to mull over in this. I do suggest reading the links that are in our show notes, and I also do suggest you go and watch his speech, okay? Somebody videotaped it with an iPhone or some other handheld thing. It's not great quality, but the sound is clear, and you can hear him. Go listen to it, read his stuff, read the articles. Try and stay away from all the bad press where people just get mad at him. I know that Devin Faraci from Chud on Twitter was literally bagging shit on him before the film even screened at Sundance. It was like, I've never seen so much negativity, you know? And it's like, you sit there and go, boy, not even giving the man a chance to show. Because look, bottom line is, forget the distribution at this point. Is the film any good?
Yeah.
And the overall consensus is this film will shock you. It will surprise you. It may not be a perfect film, but for Kevin Smith, this is a real departure from anything he's ever done.
Yeah.
You know? And I, for one, am just dying to see it.
Yeah. No, me too, man.
Delta Knight says, sorry, Dave, I'm not donating money for the Geek Actually Cinema. It's all right. I don't think we could ever raise enough money to open our own cinema. Yeah. All right, so a lot of people say money doesn't make you happy, but that's from a position of people with money, says James from Melbourne. Yeah, fair enough. Iron Mouse says, saying that misery is having no money is a very close-minded view of the world. Yes, it is. Fair enough. All right, let's move on from Kevin Smith at this point, and we'll kind of cut this a bit short because we are running a little bit long now with Kevin Smith, but let's just talk about the Oscar noms real quick. The Oscar nominations came out a few days ago. We got them up. The complete list is up on geekactually.com. We're not going to go through them nomination by nomination. Don't worry. But I think it should be fair to say that we can start giving some prelim comments. I'm not going to put out my official predictions until probably about a week before the things, because quite frankly, I haven't seen all the films yet. I'm still working on it. But I can say with pretty much a lot of certainty, I actually predict the acting awards already. Yeah. I think I've pretty much got those locked down.
Yeah.
Now, the actress is in a leading role. Annette Bening, The Kids Are All Right, Nicole Kidman, Jennifer Lawrence for Winter's Bone, Nicole Kidman for Rabbit Hole. I skip over her because I don't think she's got a chance. Natalie Portman, Black Swan, Michelle Williams for Blue Valentine. I can actually pretty much lock down actress already, and I think Natalie Portman's going to walk. He's going to walk it.
I totally agree.
I don't think there is a doubt in anybody's mind that Natalie Portman is going to walk it. And same with actor. At this point, I don't think there's any doubt. We've got Javier Bardem, Jeff Bridges, Jesse Eisenberg, Colin Firth, and James Franco. I actually don't think there's any doubt that Colin Firth is going to walk away with this Oscar. As much as I love Jeff Bridges in True Grit, don't get me wrong.
I love Jeff Bridges, Bridges as well, but I actually am more of a Jesse fan for this. It would be between Colin Firth and Jesse for me because I thought, look, I've seen it again recently, Social Network, and I've got to say, look, he is just phenomenal in that film. And for someone of his age, just starting an acting career, I think it's just such an amazing performance. So I would actually put those two. I think Jeff Bridges did an amazing job, but Jeff Bridges just won one.
Yeah,
so.
I think with Jeff Bridges and Colin Firth are playing tag at this point. Because last year, everybody said that Colin Firth should have got it for A Simple Man. Jeff Bridges took it for Crazy Heart. This year, everybody's saying Jeff Bridges should get it for True Grit. But I think Colin Firth is going to take it for The King's Speech. I think Colin Firth is pretty much a walk on that one too. Not as much as Natalie Portman, but I think he's pretty much a walk on that one. And the supporting actor roles are the same. I think in supporting actor, you've got Christian Bale, John Hawkes, Jeremy Renner, Mark Ruffalo, and Jeffrey Rush. I think Christian Bale's a walk. I think for The Fighter, the amount of buzz that he's gotten for this film, I haven't even seen the film, but the amount of buzz that he's got for this film, people are saying he's the star of the film, not Mark Wahlberg, you know? And so I would say that Christian Bale is going to walk with The Fighter. And it's the same with actress in supporting role. Look, Amy Adams is supposed to be great in The Fighter. Helena Bonham Carter was great in The King's Speech. Melissa Leo and Jackie Weaver in Animal Kingdom. But Hailee Steinfeld, I think, is going to walk away with it. She's the first child actor since Anna Paquin to win, and I think she's going to walk away with it, quite frankly. I think she was terrific as Maddie. And let's face it, the Oscars love doing something radical like that, especially in these supporting categories. Where I'm a little bit on and writing, I'm not even going to run through the nominations. Aaron Sorkin will win for The Social Network in the Best Adapted Screenplay category. There is, I don't even know why they even bothered nominating anybody else, quite frankly. In the original screenplay, however, that's a little bit tougher because you've got The King's Speech, which is a great screenplay, and you've got The Another You, and you've got The Fighter, and you've got The Kids Are All Right, but you've also got Inception. You know, so it's a tough call. The original screenplay is a tough call this year. And I also think directing is a tough call because Aronofsky did an amazing job with Black Swan. King's Speech was, I don't think he'll get the director.
I don't think he'll get the director, no.
David Fincher did a great job in Social Network, and the Coen brothers have done a great job, and they've never won one.
I am still sticking with my guns on that one. I think it'll be Black Swan.
You think it'll be Black Swan? And, of course, Best Picture, they've done the whole 10 pictures again, which I don't even know why they bother. I don't know at this point. It's a toss-up between The Social Network, which I think is my personal choice.
My pick for animated is Toy Story 3. Oh, yeah, easy. I'm putting that out there. Easy. I don't think anything even comes close.
No, easy call. I think the Best Picture is going to come down to a three-way fight, and it's going to come down to True Grit, Black Swan, and Social Network. Even though Inception's a great film, science fiction films never
win. Hey, and I'm not even going to go that far. I think to completely intoxicate me and take me somewhere and make me feel exactly what the character's feeling, I don't think it goes in the same leagues as a lot of these films that we've seen this year. Mm. King's Speech and Black Swan. These films just deserve it.
Yeah, and look, Inception is a fantastic film.
Look, Inception's made its money. Absolutely. It doesn't need awards.
It's made its money. It's blown people's minds. It's done all those sort of things. But the problem, on a purely Oscar bent, films about the fantastical are a tough sell.
Yeah.
They very rarely win anything at the Oscars because the Oscars are a bunch of old biddies who don't like to go for the new. They go for... And let's face it, the reason why I say King's Speech has a chance is King's Speech is a costume drama.
Mm.
And a costume drama has a very good chance of winning just because it is a costume drama. I'm about 90% sold on the fact that I think Social Network will take it.
Yeah.
What we really need is we need to see all the minor awards leading up to it because those are all pointers and indicators as to know what the voters are thinking.
Mm.
And I think that once we start seeing things like the DGA award and all this stuff, we're going to have a much clearer idea of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The more important awards were also announced, which of course were the Golden Raspberry Awards, which I love the Golden Raspberries.
Yeah.
And I got to say, there are some wonderful films in here, and I just want to – some of my highlights. And we're not going to go through all the nominations, but we will do our predictions on this once again as we get a bit closer to it. But I think the fact that in the – where is it? In the best – sorry, worst. I should get back to worst now. On the worst screen couple or screen ensemble of the year, I think it's fair to say that the entire cast of Sex and the City 2 – the entire cast of Twilight Saga Eclipse and the entire cast of The Last Airbender is a tough call. Which one do you pick out of those? You know?
I don't think there
And is. Also, Josh Brolin's face and Megan Fox's accent were nominated in A for Jonah Hex.
Man, those guys must be hated so badly. It's awesome.
The only film that I'm in the Golden Raspberries that I think is actually a bit of a problem is the fact that they've nominated Vampires Suck in several of the categories, and all I can think is that film was never meant to be good.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is actually being nominated all over the place.
I think because it's a piss take that finally deserves recognition for actually jumping across the line of being shit.
Maybe.
Like, we didn't need the film. This was brought up when it first came out. It was like, we didn't need A Vampire Sucked. We knew it sucked.
That's true. Right. Now, we've had James Milman says, why doesn't The Asylum get nominated more? The Asylum makes television movies. And I don't think they have a Raspberries for TV, do they?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think they do. So I will say this. So let's put one nomination out there. Let's just do a prelim nomination, Josh.
Yep.
Worst film of the year: The Bounty Hunter, The Last Airbender, Sex and the City 2, Twilight Saga, Eclipse, Vampires Suck.
I would say I think the worst picture of the year was definitely Airbender.
I agree.
Because, look, all of the others have reasons backwards and forwards, and I don't think Twilight Eclipse was that bad. Like, I don't think it deserves worst picture of the year. There was a hell of a lot worse that came out this year. But realistically,
and look, Last Airbender... I'm sure Sex and the City 2 is a bad film as
it's
well.
It's horrifying and insulting and racist and everything.
But The Last Airbender is a film that was so misguided in every possible way.
Yeah.
And it had every opportunity to be a good film and completely screwed the pooch.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, and that's why I would give it worst picture of the year. All right, let's move on. Those are the nominations. We will have this year a special Oscar show as we do every year. We watch the Oscars live and then we do an immediate recording straight afterwards on our impressions. And hopefully we will have Mirren here for that because she's done the last couple, so it'll be nice to get her in here again.
Yep.
So we will see how we go with that. And we will put out our predictions the week before. We'll give our final predictions on the major categories, and we'll see how right or wrong we can be.
Yeah.
All right, let's do our list of five. As I say, this is suggested by Rachel, co-host of the Funky Film Show, Radio Fremantle 107.9 FM, or find them at radiofremantle.com. And the list is five great westerns. And I just wanted to do a quick reminder that our lists are not top five lists.
Yeah.
It kind of feels that way sometimes. But when we first started doing lists, we said we didn't want to do a top five list because everybody does top fives. Our lists, that's why they're called lists of five. Basically, what we do is we list five films that we think you should see, basically.
Well, my top five is actually based on the original words from her, which are five great westerns.
That's right.
They don't have to be
the best westerns,
yeah,
but they are five great westerns.
They're five westerns that you should see.
Absolutely.
And if you haven't seen them, and they go all over the place. This list is as bipolar as you can possibly imagine.
Fair enough. And so we just put that out as a reminder that our lists are not always necessarily a top five.
Yeah.
And because we've shut the forum down, you may have noticed we've closed the forums because it was getting spammed to death and I didn't have time to maintain it. Our lists of five have all been transferred to our Facebook fan page.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to our Facebook fan page, click the discussion tab, you'll see all the lists of five are listed there. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do this. Josh, what's your number five in five great westerns?
My number five is actually one of the, sort of actual top five kind of ones, which is a recent film. Funnily enough, actually one of the films she actually brought up, which was The Assassination of Jesse James.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's bleak, it's dark, the acting in it is incredible. I think the roles brought to light people that I either thought really highly of and now think incredibly highly of, or put a tick marker beside people that I thought I needed to keep an eye on. And even though the pace is slow, I think the ending is a really big payoff. So I think everybody should see it if you've got time. And I do mean put aside 3 or 4 hours.
Cool.
It's incredibly depressing.
I will do it. I have actually been meaning to see that for a long time.
Yep.
There was the last couple of years, there's been a couple of westerns, 310 to Yuma, the Assassination of Jesse James, and I just haven't got to them, and it's I really do have to catch up and see a couple of these. Okay, my number five is Silverado. We mentioned it earlier. 1985 film directed and written by Lawrence Kasdan. And Lawrence Kasdan, if that name doesn't ring a bell, he was the writer-director of The Big Chill.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, for us geeks out there, he was the writer of Raiders of the Lost Ark and Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
I think Silverado is just a rollicking good adventure. It takes itself too seriously. It's a lot of fun. And it was a real return to that old Western style. I just loved it. I thought the characters were great. And Jeff Goldblum was a lot of fun. So a good cast. An ensemble cast like Big Chill. I mean, it's literally like everybody in Under the Sun was in it. And it's just a great, fun ride. And if you haven't seen it, it is well worth having a look at. Not to be taken too seriously.
No, definitely not. Speaking of not being taken seriously, my number four is Blazing Saddles.
Oh, I didn't think of it.
Like, Blazing Saddles is just the classic comedy that is Western-based. I mean, it's got the touch of everything that was great about its time. It's incredibly non-PC in every aspect, right down to, sort of
I
casting.
I love Blazing Saddles. I think Blazing Saddles is a very funny film.
Exactly.
I actually remember seeing it at the cinema. I'm old. Did I debate?
Yes. Yeah, no, I'm aware of that. Look, I just got to say, it is incredibly funny. It is everything that is good about comedy, and it's a Western.
And
so
all I'll say this: more beans, Mr. Taggart. Mongo-like beans. All right. Now, my number four is actually a Sergio Leone film. Now, Sergio Leone is responsible for, all the great spaghetti westerns.
Leave them off the list because they might be on mine.
Exactly. There's a whole slew of them. To me, though, his best film of that genre was Once Upon a Time in the West, made in 1968, featuring one of the very few bad guy performances by Henry Fonda, who was always the good guy. Henry Fonda was loved by all, and he was so despicably evil in Once Upon a Time in the West that you're mesmerized, glued to the screen to watch how bad he could be. Once again, put aside 3 hours for this movie. It's an epic, but it is, for me personally, his crowning glory to his spaghetti westerns. Your number
three. My number three is it's no sort of secret that I am a fan of very bizarre films and very bizarre genres. I think if you haven't seen it, one of the really good westerns, just for doing a completely different take on everything that is Western, is Dead Man with Johnny Depp.
Oh, I didn't
Yeah.
I forgot about that one, too.
Yeah, no, I just
interesting
think...
Interesting film.
Exactly. Look, I mean, it's shot in black and white. It's very kind of low budget in a lot of ways. It's got some great sort of winks for sort of fans of that genre. But more importantly, it's just a great story. I just really liked it. I mean, it's depressing as all hell, but it's a really bizarre film, and I think if you're into Westerns and you've exhausted everything that is spaghetti Western and everything that is modern Western, it's an interesting take that I think people should go into.
I actually didn't even think about it, because I don't think of it as a Western.
Yeah, but yeah, it really is.
It really is. Okay, my number three is Sam Peckinpah's 1969 Uber classic, which there's actually been rumors kicking around that they want to remake this, which makes little...
Blood vessels. I know. Yeah,
Which is the Wild Bunch,
which
for me was for the world was actually one of the
Will Smith can do the track for it.
Oh God, the Wild Bunch was one of the films that first introduced uber violence to the Western. The final shootout is a bloodbath.
Yeah,
introduced that whole Sam Peckinpah slow motion death scenes. A truly remarkable film, and one of a kind. And I don't and I don't know if you could actually remake this film.
Yeah.
Sam Peckinpah was insane, and it reflects in his films. He was a gun-toting right-wing maniac. And I don't know if in this politically correct PC world, anybody could actually do The Wild Bunch the way that he did it. So I say to the studios out there, leave it alone, take your hand off of it, and just... leave The Wild Bunch alone. Now, The Wild Bunch has been remastered and is available on Blu-ray and DVD in this beautiful remastered edition. Buy it. Absolutely buy it. This film is a classic. All right, your number two.
My number two is a very obvious one, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. If you haven't seen it, then just give up and stop watching films, or go and watch it right now.
Yeah,
either
no,
way,
look,
I'll
great
accept
film.
One of the
only reason it's not on my list is because I only want to put one Sergio Leone. So
Look, I tossed up between the two, man, and I stuck with my guns on it because, look, I just think it's one of those films that got me into filmmaking, like film reviewing.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
It's just one of those films that I just went out immediately and talked to everyone I knew about it. And
James from Melbourne, wash your mouth out with soap. He says Wild Bunch is out of date, though. Wash your mouth. Nothing will ever date that movie. How can you date a period film?
I know. Anyway.
Yes, Wild Bunch is a thing of its time. Absolutely.
Yep.
But it is still well worth watching. All right. Now, yes, Good and Bad and the Ugly, which is actually, I believe, the third in the trilogy. Is that right? Starting with A Fistful of
Dollars
for a few dollars
more and
then
The Good and Bad and the Ugly.
They finish off with The Good and Bad and the Ugly. All good films.
Yeah.
But Good and Bad and the Ugly is the crowning glory.
Yep.
And let's face it, Sergio Leone. How could anybody have thought they could get away with, and he did, a scene where three people stand off and literally stand there for 5 minutes doing nothing?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not exaggerating. They're standing for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Staring at each other.
Absolutely.
it's an amazing...
There's only a few men in the world that can pull that off.
It's an amazing sequence. My number two is the George P. Cosmatos film, 1993, Tombstone. Which I absolutely...
Well, we may as well start going into that then, because that's my number one.
That's your number one, okay.
Yep, greatest Western film of all time, in my opinion. I just think it is so good.
Absolutely loved it. It's not my number one, as I have one more on top of this, but I absolutely love Tombstone. I remember seeing it at the cinema thinking, George P. Cosmatos was not a great director. He'd made Leviathan, and he'd made Rambo First Blood Part 2, and he did the Cassandra Crossing, and when I heard he was doing Western, it's like, really? Is this kind of... But he pulled that together, and from what I understand, he was a last-minute replacement on the film. He wasn't even supposed to direct it.
Dude, that film was made by its actors.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
The cast.
It was made by the
just...
actors and the mustaches.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And
I mean,
all genuine mustaches.
Yeah.
They normally in these films they paste them on and stuff. Those big handlebars are all real.
Yeah. Look, you know? I mean, Kurt Russell is amazing. Val Kilmer is the best performance he has
Sam
ever
Elliott
done
for the win.
Sam Elliott. It's just no one in that film was not. It's like they went out and they went, find me the most rugged actors in Hollywood. Give me a couple of other ones and let's just chuck them all.
Finest performance of Val Kilmer's career. Finest performance of Michael Biehn's career, followed closely by The Abyss as the going crazy army guy. But finest performances from these two people.
Yeah, Powers
in their
Booth.
Entire career. Powers Booth, brilliant.
Amazing.
Brilliant.
Yeah, no, it's just it's Sam Elliott who just, you can just never...
Yeah, I mean, his mustache just, it could act on its own.
Yeah, no, and it's just, and that whole lead up to what is the OK Corral fight
and
is just
as
incredible.
Soon as he redons that Marshall's badge and they just go through that montage sequence where he's just rounding cowboys up, he doesn't go, badass! And there's that one shot I love where they're chasing the cowboys, the bad guys are known as the cowboys and they wear the red sashes and they're chasing the cowboys across the desert, and you just see them ripping the sashes off the throne.
I'm done.
It's like, I'm out.
Like you said, Val Kilmer is probably the highlight. He is the one that holds that
you
film.
You must be Mr. Ringo.
He's just, every line he pulls is amazing. Every time he speaks, it's just awesome. His line where he's drunk and he's on that balcony and the guy goes, you're probably seeing double. And he pulls out, he's got his gun out already, and he pulls out the other one and goes, I have two guns, one for the each of you. And it's just...
Oh, the sequence where he does the whole flipping what you normally do with a gun, but he does it with the cup.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then puts it into his belt. Yeah. You know, sensational film. Just, it is everything that you want a Western to be. You know, and it's just, it's one of those amazing films, and all I can think is, wow, you know, it's just fantastic. And it's just come out on Blu-ray recently, so I've got to replace my DVD with a Blu-ray. Absolutely. It's a great film. All right, so that's your number one. So what's your number two? Your number two was?
I already did your number two.
It's my number one.
Yes.
Confused me because we were sharing there. My number one, of course, I have to give it to Unforgiven, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Unforgiven in 1992, directed by Clint Eastwood. This was a film that he actually bought 10 years earlier and put the script in a drawer because he said, I'm not old enough to play this yet.
Yeah.
And I admire that greatly. Yeah. It is a film about an aging gunfighter in a world that is changing, and he goes out on this one last thing. And Bill Mumy is one of those great characters, or Bill Mumy is one of those great characters that Clint Eastwood will forever be remembered for.
Yeah.
It is bleak, it is dark, it is quiet, and quite frankly, that last shootout, when he finally basically does something, is like awe-inspiring.
Mm.
And when he is talking about burying his friend, who they've got on the porch, you sit and go, okay!
Just let him do it.
And I'm sorry, there's spoilers here, but I'm assuming a lot. I mean, this is a film that is almost over 20 years old. But there's a scene in it where Gene Hackman, also a fantastic performance, laying on the ground, bleeding. We're in the conclusion, and he just looks up and goes, I was building a house, you know? And it's like that amazing piece of dialogue. And you sit there and you just go, this is just a film that is just perfect.
Yep. Everyone that was in that project wanted that to work and just wanted 100% out of themselves. And it shows.
Yeah.
It's just, it's awe-inspiring. I'm going to watch it. I've got it on Blu-ray. It's still in the packaging.
I've got it on DVD. I'm going to watch it. I might watch that tonight, actually. Makes me want to see it again now.
Yeah.
It's such a good film, and well and truly, that is on my number one. And let's be very clear, it's not called The Unforgiven. The title of the film is just Unforgiven.
And if you've seen the film, you know why.
I remember when it came out, and everybody's going, have you seen The Unforgiven yet? It's like, it's not called The Unforgiven. That's not what it's about.
The Unforgiven.
It's Unforgiven.
Yeah.
So that is my number one. And I also put a couple honorary mentions. This was a hard one because there's actually a lot of really good Westerns out there. But I did actually mention that in my honorary mentions, you should also have a look at Hang 'Em High, which is another Clint Eastwood film.
I have some as well.
Okay, Hang 'Em High is another one where basically a man is wrongly hung and he comes back to town to wreak his revenge.
Winchester 76.
Winchester 76 is another one. And
High Plains Drifter.
High Plains Drifter, that's a great film.
Yeah.
The Town Red. And the other one that I really want to mention was a John Wayne film. Now, I'm not a huge John Wayne fan. I like True Grit a lot.
I think they're silly, but if you can get past that, they're fun.
Until his twilight years, and his last film before he died was a film called The Shootist.
Yeah.
And he was nominated, and I believe he actually won posthumously the Academy Award again. The Shootist tells the story of an aging gunfighter who is dying.
Yeah.
And he is like the best gunfighter in the world, but he's dying, and it's all about like leaving his legacy behind. And it's an amazing film. It really is a good film.
God damn it, I got that one at home too.
So The Shootist is really good and really well worth having a look at if you haven't seen it. John Wayne is a one-note actor.
Yeah.
But when that one note works within the context of the film, as in True Grit and The Shootist, it works very well. The Searchers is also a good one, but not one of my favorites. Yep. A lot of people love The Searchers and say The Searchers is like his greatest film. Not my favorite. My favorite is The Shooters. I like his old, where he was the old crotchety, grumpy man much more. Yep. So,
if you want a complete depart from everything that is standardized Western, The Quick and the Dead.
Oh, I forgot about The Quick and the Dead. I actually love The Quick and the Dead. It's so stupid, but I love it.
It's so stupid and it's so ridiculous, but it is just awesome. I would also like to put in, these I couldn't put on because the TV series, I would like to put on Cowboy Bebop, which is an anime series, very much holding to this thing. It is all set in the future, but everything about it is very Western and very gunslinger bounty hunter. I would like to put down Deadwood, which is...
Not a movie, but well worth seeing.
Well worth putting on your list. Trigun, which again is set kind of future slash... kind of cowboy-esque kind of a thing, but just a really awesome series that goes to some places you will not see it going. But again, very Western in its mentality, which is what's really cool about it. And of course, the last one is Firefly. And if you haven't seen Firefly, it's everything that is Western, but with spaceships.
So, Calicentha said, I doubt Tombstone and Unforgiven are on iTunes. I just did a quick search for you. Both Unforgiven and Tombstone are available for rental on iTunes. So,
yeah, take that.
So take that. You can get them there. And for the person, I will remain nameless, who says, nah, I don't want to pay for them. Support the film industry.
James from Melbourne, if you can get it, I don't care how, if you can get it for $23, I think, from JB Hi-Fi. It is a TV series that only lasted one season.
Which one's this?
And
which one?
Firefly.
Oh, Firefly. Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
And it is the guys that did Buffy doing a much more bleak kind of.
It's just Whedon's. It was a science fiction series.
Yes.
But he fashioned a science fiction series like an old Western, and they all carry
right down to the point. They have six shooters, they use shotguns.
And they go to planets where they're, you know, on horse-drawn carriages, and it's just, it is brilliant.
Yeah, it's a very cool concept, and it's definitely worth the money, because up until the last episode, everything is basically win. Every episode.
Every episode's a win, and they killed it long before it was due, and then, of course, they made the film to finish it up called Serenity.
And don't watch that, because it'll just make you sad.
It'll make you sad. It's a good film, but it'll make you sad.
Yeah. Yeah, look, also, look at the chat room going nuts over that.
You can watch Serenity as well, because it will give you an idea of what sort of director Joss Whedon is, because he's directing The Avengers.
Yep. And also watch all these things that I've suggested, because they will all make you really aware of why cowboys and aliens will work. That's all I'm going to say.
Absolutely. All right, so that's our list. If you have agreeances or disagreements with our list, jump into our fan page. You can add your comments to the bottom of our lists on the Facebook fan page. The fan page is simply facebook.com/geek. Actually, but all the links are on our site, including our Twitter, our Tumblrs, and everything else that we do. Just go to geekactually.com. You'll find it all there. We also have merchandise, which you can also pick up at geekactually.com. You'll find the links for all of that stuff. We want to just remind you that we also do a geek and tech podcast. It's called Geek Actually. It is recorded live before this show. Goes out on iTunes on Mondays. It is all your tech and geek and weird news that we put out for the week, and it's a lot of fun. If you aren't subscribed to that, look for Geek Actually on the iTunes for subscribing to it, or you can find it on our website. Just a reminder for those who might only be tuning in for the first time, when you type a Geek Actually search, you'll also come across a podcast called Tech Actually that is now defunct. Don't subscribe to that one. The new episodes are all going out on the Geek Actually feed. Okay? If you like this show, if you listen to this show and you are an iTunes user, please send us a comment or two on iTunes. It would be very, very helpful, especially from our North American listeners. Yeah. Really need to get those numbers up. So please drop us a review. It would be great. Look, be honest. I'm not going to say 5 stars or nothing. Anything you want. Tell us what you think. And we also want to talk about a few of our friends. We've already mentioned Rachel at the Funky Film Show. Excuse me. We want to mention our friends Real Junkies, R-E-E-L Junkies. They are a podcast like ours. They do film reviews, but they do it under the influence of tequila, which is always fun. And we are going to be trying to get some of them on this show over the coming weeks/months. Mm-hmm. They're threatening to all come on at once. that's going to be a nightmare. But we'll see if we can get them on.
Five voices over Skype just never happens.
No, it
well.
Doesn't work well. So we're going to see if we can get them in one at a time. Maybe we'll do a group session at another time. We'll see. But we'll see how we go with that. We are trying to get time up. The doing time differences is always tricky between America and Australia. So we are trying to work all that out. You can watch the show live. We start recording right after Geek, actually. So the start time is between 1:30, 2 o'clock-ish normally, Australian Eastern Daylight Savings Time. We start our broadcast at 12 with Geek Actually, and then this records afterwards. Mm-hmm. That's at geekactually.com/live. We also have friends here, not just over there at weekendrenan.com with the Real Junkies, but we have friends here. And what would those friends be?
Oh, right, you're pointing at me. RawDLC.com, it's a gaming website. Go over and check it out. If you are watching this live, go out and check out the new post we put up, I think it was yesterday, which has a very funny video that you should all watch. It is about a user review for a Flash game online, but it is really good, so work that out in your heads. Other than that, we have a live show, 8 p.m. Tuesday, Australian Eastern Standard Time. Come over. We do the same live sort of thing, but we talk about games.
Cool. Excellent. Now, we also want to just shout out to our friend Josh Spencer, who did our wonderful cartoon artwork for our album art. That's what the word I was looking for. Find your words. Album art, Josh Spencer over at attackninja.blogspot.com. And I think we're done. Oh, no, I forgot to say. We said send your feedback. Where should you send your feedback to?
You should probably tell them where to send your feedback.
Feedback at geekactually.com, or you can drop us voicemail 02-8011-3167, or our Skype ID is geekactually. Cool. All right, so you can leave voicemail that way as well. We all done?
Yep, I think we're done, Dave.
We're done. In that case, I'm going to say go see more movies. You don't see enough movies. And all of life's questions are answered at the movies, and we will see you all next week. Bye now.
Bye.